offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. Sorry for the slight delay, we had a little technical snag there. But now we are on and we are here to continue with our satsang on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. Beautifully documented interactions with Swami, which Dr. John Hislop was blessed to have. And some of the interactions were involving even other people who were there present around Swami. We are in the middle of a very important discussion, a very profound and deep discussion. As we have spoken many times about the background from which Dr. Hislop comes, he is a person who has done a lot of sadhana. He has done a lot of spiritual exercises in different traditions, if I could put it that way. So some of the questions that he's asking is based on all of those experiences. And Swami gives clarifications on what the mind is, how the mind has to be prepared for spiritual sadhana and all of that. Part of that we went through last time. This is going to be a continuation of that. So before that, we offer our most loving pranams at Swami's lotus feet. And we pray that he helps us understand what is being said. Because one thing is very clear, that it is not for anyone who has not given serious thought about it. So we'll only pray that Swami gives us the understanding to grasp what Swami is explaining here. So let's invite Arvind to join all of us before we start the discussion. Sai Ram, Arvind.
Sai Ram, Prem, and Sai Ram to all our listeners. Last week when we began this satsang, it started with a question from Hislop where he says that, Swami, the mind is so dangerous. And there was the elaborate discussion on the mind, different facets of it, which was enlightening, which was wonderful. Interestingly, after hearing all that and after all that discussion, Hislop comes back, and this week too we have the start similar to the previous one, because Hislop says, Swami has said that the mind need not be dangerous, but with all the trouble it has brought about, it seems to be very dangerous. It's almost like the whole discussion happened because of the question that the mind is dangerous. But Swami, at the end of the discussion, instead of clearing doubts and clearing the fear that the mind is dangerous, it only seems to have enhanced the fear that the mind is very, very dangerous for a spiritual aspirant. And Swami replies to it very beautifully. Swami says, the mind creates no harm, gives no trouble, as long as it is... The mind creates no harm and gives no trouble as long as it is not merged with the body senses. For instance, the mind has a thought of a theater. No harm. But if mind picks up body and carries it to the theater, then it becomes involved with the movie, the people, the emotions, the concepts, and the peace is lost. The mind should not engage itself in the body senses. The body senses should serve the needs of the body only. Mind should be engaged in the five mind senses, which are truth, concentration, peace, love, and bliss. So Swami makes it very clear that mind by itself is not dangerous. Depending on whose company it keeps, it either becomes dangerous or it becomes uplifting. That is what I think a mention was made of, Mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo. Well, it was not made, it is coming ahead. Where it says that the mind alone is responsible for the bondage as well as liberation of man. So Swami says it depends on whose company it keeps. And Swami strongly forbids the mind from keeping the company of the body senses. And Swami says that the body senses are gifted to us to help us in our bodily needs. The eyes, the ears, the sense of smell, you know it. They are more like hygiene needs, safety needs. Before we eat food, we get the aroma, we smell it. We get to know whether it's turned bad or not. And by chance the sense of smell fails, we have the sense of taste that tells us that it is harmful food. It is not good food, don't eat it. Similarly, when we are walking on the road, the eyes are there to help us navigate safely. These senses are given for the protection and upkeep of the body. And Swami says that they must be restricted to that alone. The mind should not mingle with them. On the other hand, Swami says the mind should mingle with the five mind senses. And let me confess, this is the first time that I am hearing this term, mind senses. And Swami says the five mind senses are truth, concentration, peace, love and bliss. Satya, Shanti, Prema, Ananda and concentration, which possibly can be either Dhyana or Dharana or Samadhi.
Right, and this is of course something which Swami has said in as many words as possible, where he says that, you know, the mind is only an instrument. It's all about how you use it. But one thing is very clear. I think even in the previous week's discussion, Swami was telling the importance of buddhi and the intelligence and the sense of purpose which a spiritual aspirant always has. Because when Swami says, you know, the mind is not bad, but it is indulging with the body and the senses in what the mind wants to do is the problem. To know that it is not, the mind should not be followed. I think that intelligence itself comes only from a purposeful life, where one knows that one is not supposed to just go after whatever one craves for and one desires for. That comes from that purposeful life. And I think that is the most important thing, because otherwise, how do you know that the mind should not be followed? Right? Because as you were saying, that's what Swami would say, the senses are meant to measure what is in front of you. You know, something is green when it is supposed to be yellow, fruit is supposed to be yellow, it's ripe. So the eye gives you an indication of whether that is ready to be eaten or not. Similarly, the sense of smell, as you said. So that gives us an indication that whatever is appealing to the senses, then you have to indulge in it. To know that there is something more than just indulging, I think itself comes from a spiritual understanding.
And for that, I think the other message from Bhagwan, which though not mentioned here, which Swami keeps telling, I think we discussed this last time also, is... maybe not last time, but in one of the previous sessions, is about the company we keep, the satsang, the good company. Because, you know, I was just reading a very interesting article.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it has proved or if there is scientific data to support it, but it definitely made a thought-provoking read. It said that you are an average of the 5 people you spend the time most with, including yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it's another way of saying, tell me your company, I'll tell you who you are. So you think of the 5 people with whom you spend the most time with, add yourself into it, your own thoughts and ideas, and average this, that is what you turn out to be over time. It shows how vital it is. You know, we may have 1,500 friends on Facebook or 400 friends on Facebook or social media and all that, but the time we spend with the 5 people closest to us is what determines us. And that's why this inner circle is so important. And for us, as Swami's devotees, it shows how important it is that we get Swami into this 5 at least. You know, if Swami is possibly not the sole goal of our life, he should definitely be in these 5. Otherwise, we are only, you know, upgrading ourselves or degrading ourselves based on the company we keep. Now the question also may be asked, as it always asked, as to how do we, if I say the 5 most important people in my life are possibly my mother, my father, my wife, my daughter and Swami, if I say 5. The question that comes, and myself, I'm the 6th. The question that comes is, I can keep the company of my parents, my wife and my child. How do I keep Swami's company? Years ago it would be visiting Prashanthi Nilayam. Well, now also it can be visiting Prashanthi Nilayam, because all said and done, at the altar there is that vibration where we feel his presence, though we may not be able to see it with the eyes. But there are also other ways, you know. Directly we can keep in touch by, as I said, visiting Prashanthi Nilayam or visiting our own Sai centers, visiting Samitis. All said and done, these are places where devotees congregate and spread the vibrations of love of Bhagwan, the grace of Bhagwan. So definitely Bhagwan is there. That is possibly the direct contact we can have in this era. When direct contact doesn't become possible, the other way we can be in touch with this person is through his or her work. Swami's work. We have Swami's work. You know, that is the Vahinis, the discourses, where it is his voice, his words. We can still be in touch with it. That is the second way. And the third way is, you know, something that I have personally practiced and I find it so uplifting, beautiful, motivating, is this visualization. We can visualize Swami. I can close my eyes, think of Swami, think that he is here, and, you know, plan out. When I was thinking of this, very interestingly, I came across a piece by Napoleon Hill. Napoleon Hill is a best-selling author. He has written a book about, I forget the title, but the book deals with how you have to think rich to become rich, you know. So it's all about wealth. But in that, he tells one very interesting point, a thing that he practices. Let us remember, this book was written in the 1930s. And even to this day, it sells. So he writes there that he needs to keep good company. And therefore, he says he has his advisors and counselors. And some of his advisors and counselors are people who are beyond his reach. For instance, if I say that the Prime Minister of India is one person I admire and I want him to be in my five, it's not possible for me to meet with him or talk to him on phone. But yes, what he says is stunning. He says that I sit every night at a table with all my counselors around me and I have a meeting with them. You know, it's only in his mind. And yet he says it helps him a lot. Now, I was thinking after reading this that if this is the impact he has felt with people as counselors who are human beings, how wonderful it will be if we can bring God. God every night before we sleep, if we bring Swami and hold a discussion. So, I feel that if we have to educate the mind not to go and indulge with the body senses for it to know that there is a higher purpose, we need to engage in good company. And this is very interesting, practical I felt. Let me pick six people who are most important in my life and ensure that in that six, Swami also figures. And let me ensure that on a daily basis, I spend some time with these six, because the average of this is what is going to make me.
The other thing which struck me from what Swami was saying just here, because he said, you know, the thoughts and mind come, but you don't have to indulge it. In it with your body and the senses. I think the corollary of that is if you're talking about keeping your mind in the company of the good, in truth, in peace, in love, I think the corollary works. That when the mind entertains such thoughts, follow it with your body and your senses. Right? And that's what Swami would often say, that, you know, when you, I think we spoke about it even last week, when you have a good thought, put it into practice right away. The other easy thing, oftentimes when you look at it, especially for those of us who have been physically close with Swami and the legacy which Swami has left. Like, if you just look at Prashanta Nilayam, if you just look at the institutions he has set, there's a concretization of what Swami likes and what Swami prefers. How you should dress, how you should speak, how you should carry yourself. That is how it has all been captured in the institutions that Swami has set up, be it in the organization or in the ashram or in the centers all around the world. You know, it has been captured in that manner. And that actually, in a way, it empowers our choices. Today, I have, you know, the kind of dress you wear is a choice that you make. And that choice, what is it driven by? Is it driven by the fashion around you? Is it driven by the people who are going to look at you? Or is it going to be driven by, this is what Swami likes? A simple choice is being used as a tool of empowerment for you to move closer to Swami. To say that, you know, I'm doing this for Swami. The way I dress, the way I, you know, fashion my hair, the way I speak, the food I eat, my habits. These are all choices. In fact, most of these are choices we don't even spend time to think why we do it. Right? Because everybody is doing it, we do it. But Swami has given us an option that even in such simple things, we can say that I am doing this for Swami. You know, people might laugh at me, people might look at me and say that I'm old-fashioned or I'm, you know, not in tune with the times, but that doesn't matter because my choice is connected to something which is much, much more higher. Because when Swami says that the mind has to be given to truth, concentration and pure bliss, these are all things probably the people outside will never be able to see. It'll show up eventually as a personality which is standing out from the rest. But people will not be able to see and there's no reward instantly for that. Right? And Swami would often say that there's a very beautiful statement, we keep coming back to that. I think in the 1990 series, Swami says that what do you do to keep your body clean? You take a bath. And you don't take a bath once in a lifetime, you take it every day. Right? Because you acknowledge that this body can become dirty and you keep having your bath every day. And Swami said, same is the case with the mind too. Because the mind is involved with the world, it'll keep getting dirty and you have to keep giving it a bath. And Swami says, what is water to the body? Truth is to the mind.
To clean it.
Right. So he says, keep repeating it, even if you don't believe that you're divine, even if you don't believe, I mean, we all know that Swami is above us, below us, all around us. But we don't have that experience every day. Swami says, keep repeating it to yourself because you are actually washing your mind with the truth. You're not letting dirt settle down in the mind.
Like you rightly said, these concepts of truth, concentration, peace, love and bliss, it might be difficult for us to practically concretize. That's where having the avatar of the age guide us becomes so easy, because all I need to do is just think whether this is something Swami likes or not. And if I feel that I don't know whether Swami likes this or dislikes it, it just means that I have to keep more association with Swami. That is, as we repeated before, the books, the discourses, the company of people who have experienced Swami, and so on and so forth. So, thinking of that makes it very easy, and, you know, there are so many inspiring examples around us. I remember there was this brother, I will not name him because he doesn't want to be named, but he had invited us for his wedding. His wedding was in the Pathamandiram here at Puttaparthi. When we went for the wedding, imagine he's the groom and he comes dressed in white and white. You know, even in Puttaparthi, I found it a little strange. And in fact, when we went and congratulated them and stood on the stage for a photograph, I asked him, I said, what happened to you? You didn't get any dress. He said, this is a brand new dress. This is what Swami had given. That's why I had kept it for this and I'm using it for this occasion. It was after he said that I was quite amazed, and I thought, yes, look at the conviction and the feeling that this person has. And I felt, that was the example that came to my mind when you said whether I will look at the fashion trends outside or whether I will look at what Swami likes. Because, you know, come to think of it, during my wedding also, I dressed up. But if I were to sincerely think that Swami is going to come for my wedding here, I think I too would have dressed in whites. So it requires that kind of constant reminder that, you know, you said that Swami is here, Swami is in me, above me. If we are able to do that itself, I think automatically our choices will become so much grander, so much nobler. The world might not understand it, but we will be living in that awareness and we will have moved many, many steps closer to God. Another thought that comes in my mind when it comes to keeping company is, like it is said, that it is the average of the five people along with you. And by yourself, you contribute with your own thoughts. So, what do I think about more? You know, the First Lady of the United States, Eleanor Roosevelt, had quoted, and it's so beautiful. She said something like, low minds discuss people, average minds discuss events, lofty minds discuss ideas. I think this is another beautiful thumb rule for us to keep whenever we are holding any discussion or talking or interacting with people. What am I discussing? I mean, it's not as if, like, always if you discuss people, it is bad. We talk about Swami, we talk about devotees of Swami. But when we are discussing people in terms of gossiping, finding fault, it's of no meaning, no use to us. That's why we should realize that at that time our mind is at a low frequency, low vibration. Better than discussing people would be to discuss an event, possibly. Because there it's not about individuals, it's about an event that has happened. But even then, the loftiest is would be to discuss the idea or discuss an inspiration. And if we look at Swami's discourses, Prem, we will find that 80 to 90% of the discourse is only about ideas and inspiration. Maybe 7 or 8% is about events. And a rare 1 or 2% is about people, and that too most of the time it is about it is speaking positively about them. It is so fantastic. I think these are little things about Swami that we miss. Yes, we have heard many discourses, but I don't think I had ever analyzed his discourse in this fashion. So these are things also we can see and learn from Swami's life itself. That is another big advantage we have as Sai devotees, that not only have we got the teachings, we also have a role model to see and learn from.
Right, and even further what Swami says here is a reiteration of that fact that what is a limitation of the mind is actually its greatest advantage, that the mind can be involved in only one thing at a time. But Swami goes on to say, as long as the mind is so engaged, the way he said, the mind should be engaged in the five mind senses, which are truth, concentration, peace, bliss, and love. So as long as the mind is so engaged, all is well, and the person is happy and peaceful. Physical objects have a temperature potential. I think this is a little difficult to understand. We'll probably read it out and then we'll see if we can understand it. Physical objects have a temperature potential. If the breathing is fast, body temperature rises. If objects subject to temperature are added to a fire, the fire burns more fiercely. That which is subject to temperature may join with that which is subject to temperature. Mind, however, has no temperature. God is without temperature, so mind and God may merge.
The way I understood it, Prem, is I felt that the temperature or heat that Swami is speaking about is that heat of passion or desire that comes. And my understanding was, dear listeners, as Prem said, this is only our understanding. It's not that it's comprehensive. We welcome feedback. We will learn. But this is our understanding. This is my understanding. My understanding was that this is that passion, that desire that the mind gets when associated with sensory objects. That is what the Bhagavad Gita shloka also says, that when it associates with objects of attachment, it gets desire. And desire is the root cause for all the problems. So Swami is saying that by itself the mind has no desire. It is the association that decides desire. Same way God is desireless, because Swami says man minus desire is equal to God. So once you remove desire, man becomes God. So God is desireless, mind is desireless. And so Swami says just like water and water, they both will merge. If the mind is kept pure. And so the mind is basically pure because it has descended from something that is the purest. Many discourses Swami would say that the child of the Atma is the mind and the child of the mind is the speech. So whatever we speak actually has its descent from the Atma itself. And closer than the speech is the mind to the Atma. So therefore it is descending from a great lineage. It is having a fantastic gene pool, the mind. So that's why Swami says, just like, a child can donate blood to the father if the father needs, or the father can donate to the child, because it will be a perfect match. In the same way, the mind and Atma, because they are father and child, how Swami has mentioned in the discourse, they are a perfect match. And therefore, Swami says that mind has no temperature, God is without temperature, so mind and God may merge. This was my understanding.
The understanding that I get from this is, whenever Swami speaks about this temperature potential or physical objects having temperature potential, Swami would say that everything has a limitation. Like, especially while talking about the body, Swami will tell that it's got to be that precise temperature. If it falls, it's dangerous. If it raises, it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Something similar, like even the fire at the goldsmiths, whatever you call that, the oven or the hearth, what they call that. It's got to be at that that typical temperature which melts gold. If it's any lesser, it's not of any use to him. And if it's very high, probably, he'll not be able to mold the thing. So always anything that's physical has that kind of a temperature potential. Even if you look at it, physics, the melting point and the boiling point used to be the characteristic of any compound that we look at. When you produce something, it's always a characteristic.
So Swami says, Swami would say man is limited company.
Right. And it's anything that's physical has that limitation. But Swami would say, and of course this I've not heard from Swami, Professor Venkatraman would often say this. He would say there's a difference between desires of the body and the desires of the mind. He says the desires of the body will be limited by the body itself. Now there's food in front of you. The body has its own ways of limiting how much you stuff yourself with.
I can't eat more than,
right? You can't eat more than a certain amount. Same is the thing with, let's say you love to go on long walks. Your body will limit how long you can walk. There might be comparatively you can take a longer walk than others, but there is a mechanism by which the body limits.
Yeah, you can't walk 1,000 kilometers,
right?
In a day.
But you would say the desires of the mind are infinite. It can never be satisfied. And he says all the problems in the world are because of man is trying to fulfill the desires of the mind, which will never happen. Right? So in that nature, there is an unlimitedness to mind compared to anything that's physical, which is very similar to Atma, as Swami says. And that's why anything in the mind, you could go from here to America and come back mentally and you will not be tired. Right? Or you can roam around the entire Himalayas and come back and you'll feel no exhaustion in your... Because it's all mental. There is no limitation. And very beautifully Swami says in the physical thing, again, it's science. You know, what is what we call combustible usually adds to, you know, the configuration when you throw it into fire. And it's the nature of one object which actually adds to fire or puts off the fire. Mm-hmm. So Swami is saying, similarly, if you look at the mind, the mind's nature actually matches that of the Atma or of God, right? But we are pulling it down by making it get associated with something which is lesser. The other beautiful analogy which Swami will always give is that of the dust which raises from the ground. Swami would say, in the company of water, the dust comes down. In the company of the wind, the same dust rises
up
and you know, goes up. So Swami is saying that the mind has this essential quality of the Atma, which is that it is subtle, it is unlimited, it is not given to any kind of limits as we see the body and anything that's physical has. But in associating it purely with the physical, you're actually bringing it down in its potential. The more you associate it with divinity, with bliss, with love, as Swami is saying, then you're actually unleashing its potential.
There you go, dear listeners. Two interpretations of what Swami said. If you have, do write in to us at listener@radiosai.org. We will take it up whenever we can in the future date. In the meanwhile, we'll take a quick little break, and on the other side of this break, we will continue this discussion.
Charanam Shri Guru Charanam Sai Charanam Shri Guru Charanam Prarthasmaranam Shri Guru Charanam Sai Charanam Shri Guru Charanam Sai Charanam Shri Guru Charanam Prarthasmaranam Shri Guru Charanam Brahmanand Pradayaka Charanam Brahmanand Pradayaka Charanam 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 Sai Charanam Sh శరణం శరణం సాయి చ శరణం ప్రాతస్మరణం శ్రీగురు చరణం ప్రాతస్మరణం శ్రీగురు చరణం సాయిష చరణం శ్రీగురు చరణం స్మరణం శ్రీగురుచరణం బ్రహ్మానంద ప్రదాయక చరణం బ్రహ్మానంద పదాయక చరణం శరణం శరణం సాయిష చరణం శరణం శరణం సాయిష చరణం ప్రాతస్మరణం శ్రీగురుచరణం.
We just took a break when we were discussing about how the mind derives all its power from the Atma, and it brings us to the quote which says mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo, which means that mind alone is responsible for man's bondage as well as liberation. Swami has beautifully expounded this quote many times for us, and it is interesting that we found the entire Sanskrit shloka. The next line goes as bandhaya vishaya sango muktiyai nirvishayam mana, which means the same thing, which says that if it's in the sangha of vishaya, which means if it's in the company of sense objects and objects of the world, it gets bonded, it gets into bondage. And if it associates itself with things not of the world, that is with the divine, then it gets mukti. Hislop then asks, in all this, Swami, what is the definition of mind? And Swami replies, the whole complex, ego through the intelligence, may be called the mind. So I think we had a discussion on this as well, on that confusing way when we say mind. It is sad that English language doesn't have perfect words to describe, but in Sanskrit we have broken it up into the four functional aspects, which is manas, buddhi, chitta and ahankara. The manas part of the mind is that function where it associates with the sensory objects and goes along. The buddhi is that aspect which helps in discriminating function. Chitta is the memory function, and the ahankara is the self-awareness or the self-esteem function. So Swami says that therefore that ahankara or ego, from there till the intelligence, all these, this whole complex can be called the mind. Mind basically is defined as the four functions. It is not a physical entity like the brain.
In fact, there was this very interesting incident. Which we would often quote, where Swami would say that, I am ready to sublimate your mind, because Swami would say that the entire idea is to sublimate the mind, the antakarnas. So Swami would say, I am ready to sublimate the mind, that you have to give me the mind, right? So this question comes, like, what is it to give your mind to Swami? When Swami says, keep your mind in good company, what is it to give your mind to Swami? Because many times Swami would even play with that. When you tell Swami, the mind is troubling, Swami says, have you seen your mind? Does it come and catch you? So it doesn't even have a form. How can you say that it is troubling you? So in something so subtle, how do you give it to Swami, or how do you do anything with it, or how do you keep it in good company, so to say?
Mm.
If you want to understand that, I think the best way is to go back to Manas, Buddhi, Chitta and Ahankara, because those are the four qualities of the mind, the four
functions
of the mind. So the best way to do is, as Swami was saying, Manas, if you look at it, it's the working mind, or, you know, it's pretty much like, for doing something now, what am I using it? And one of the most beautiful ways Swami gives is, like, I think especially for women, Swami would say this. You know, when you're doing your daily chores at home, when you're cutting vegetables, when you're washing, when you're, rinsing or whatever it is, Swami says you can make all of that spiritual by the way you think of what you're thinking of.
Mm.
And Swami would say, when you're cutting your vegetables, think that you're cutting your ego. And, you know, when you're, I don't know exactly whatever Swami says, but Swami says that you can think of a spiritual process for any very mundane activity. So in a way, what you're doing is you're dealing with the manas aspect of the mind. That are you able to replace all the random thoughts with thoughts which are more superior? And similarly, when you go to chitta, how much time we spend in memories and what kind of memories we dig up from our mind and we spend time with.
Mm.
Right? That's a choice we always have. And there's an interesting quote I read somewhere, and it applies to all of us. We all have enough reasons to be sad. We all have enough reasons to be happy. So the choice is ours. Right? Nobody who is unhappy actually has no reason to be happy. It's just that at that moment we choose to dwell in those memories. So when you talk about the chitta function of the mind, it is like when you say giving your mind to Swami, when you're talking of chitta, it is what are the memories that you pull out from your mind or from your memory bank and you choose to spend your time with. As you said, the five company that we choose to keep, one is us, which means that solitude, what do you spend that solitude in? What memories? And similarly, when you talk about buddhi, it again goes back to the discrimination or the choice making. How much is what Swami likes becoming a part of the decision making process? If I'm going to say something, if I'm going to do something in a certain manner, the moment I say that, how would Swami want me to do it? It is again giving your mind to Swami, because you're giving that, that discrimination part of the mind to Swami. And same is the case with Ahankara. Swami would very beautifully say in a discourse, he would say that I am not an animal, I am a man, and I am not just a man, I am a Sai devotee, Swami would say. If you look at it, it's a heightened form of ego. Because Swami would say, Aham plus Akara is Ahankara. This Akara that you're trying to put there is that I am a Swami's student, or I am a Swami's devotee, I am a Swami's child. So you are using that same attribute of the mind to give an identity for itself by giving it the right identity. So Swami is saying, you know, when Swami says that when Hislop asks, which aspect of the mind are you referring to? Because it's quite a valid confusion to put forth in front of Swami, because sometimes Swami says it's only a bundle of thoughts. Sometimes Swami says that mind does not exist at all. But this aspect of the mind, which is like the antakarna, so all the inner instruments put together, is also the mind. Swami says it applies to all of this. When I say that give your mind to me, it applies to all of these functions of the mind.
And so Hislop proceeds. He says, whenever the mind falls away from necessary work, I call it to attention and keep it engaged in repeating Sai Ram, Sai Ram. Is that all right? Quite all right, Swami replies. Hislop continues, when the mind is not engaged in any particular work, where should the attention be kept? And Swami straightaway replies, between the eyebrows, that is the eye of wisdom of Lord Shiva. Nothing to discuss there.
Right. I think this was one statement which when I was reading, I was thinking that this is definitely specific probably to Hislop, who might have tried different techniques. I mean, I'm not saying that it does not apply to us. I'm sure many people would be practicing this form of meditation. And I recall many, many times when Swami would say this in Trai Vrindavan, or stand in the portico and say this, that you have to concentrate on the spot between your eyebrows.
In Sanskrit, they call it the Bhrumadhya Sthana.
Right, right.
But as you said, I think it's good to keep reminding ourselves now and then that all said and done, this is also a private conversation between Hislop and Swami. So it is not like a public discourse where, you know, the avatar intends it to.
Right.
So that disclaimer, I think it's good to keep giving now and then. And then Hislop continues, the flow of thought interferes with concentration. How to diminish thinking? And Swami replies, the habit of thinking is long-standing. Even if the habit is broken, there is a slow cessation. For example, a fan continues to revolve for a time after the switch is turned off. But the train of thought can be changed. One train of thought can stop another. The best way is to divert the train of thought to a spiritual topic. This attraction to God is spontaneous. It is the turning back to the source. All other attractions are only self-imposed. The fish is placed in a gold and jewel vase of great value, but it has no interest in the gold and jewels. It only wants to get back to the sea. Man comes into his limitation from his home. He is really of the nature of God, of this ocean of delight, of Rama, of he who attracts. The soul attracts us. Rama was God, the ocean of delight in human form. Everybody wanted to be close to him, to look at him. So, very interesting points here where one of the things I found very interesting is Swami calls thinking as a habit. We are all habitual thinkers. If we find nothing to do, we start thinking. We just keep thinking. That is the habit. And Swami says, even if you break that habit of default going into thinking when there is nothing to be done, it will not stop instantly. Just like when you switch off a fan, it takes time to stop, it stops. Swami says, all this is difficult. It is difficult to be in a thoughtless kind of state. So he says, divert the train of thought, you know, change the track. Like we, in India, we see that happening. I'm sure in every place that's what happens, where unlike vehicles on roads, you can't just turn a train. To turn a train from one track to another, there is a diversion that is done. The tracks are changed and the train automatically seems to shift from one track to another. And Swami says that's what you do, where your focus and thoughts are. Just change your train of thoughts. It's very interesting that he has used the train analogy for the train of thoughts. But this is what Swami says, turn your thoughts towards spiritual things, towards God.
And the other beautiful thing that Swami says about, you know, turning your train of thoughts to spiritual topic, I don't remember whether this was in a discourse or when Swami was talking to the students, he was talking about the Gopikas and in specific about Radha. Right, as Swami is saying here, you know, the mind's quality is that you cannot do anything to stop it. It's habituated to think. It has been created to think. So Swami would say that the Gopikas and Radha were also like that. You know, their mind also was full of thoughts, but they would always have this associated thoughts. That they would say that the moment they see a peacock, they would remember the peacock feather, and the peacock feather on Krishna's turban, and they would think of Krishna. They would look at the sky and they'll say, oh, this reminds us of the complexion of Krishna. And they'll look at a small kid, baby playing around, they'll say that, you know, oh, Krishna used to do this. Right? And they would say that, and Swami would say that, see, that is how they thought of Krishna. It is not like they sat and thought Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. They had come up with this idea, I mean, come up with this way by which everything around they would associate it with Krishna and ensure that, you know, as Swami is saying here, the train of thoughts would be diverted to towards Krishna, towards
God. That definitely
God.
Needs creativity.
Right.
Yes.
Right, creativity, and it again goes back to, you know, the company that you keep. Hmm. Because Swami would say that what you feed the mind with, that's what is going to come out. If you could put it, the mind belches out thoughts, right? And what you feed it with, that's going to be the flavor of the thoughts which come out, right? And how do you associate, for instance, I mean, that is the greatest boon of an avatar coming down in a human form does for us, right? And Swami would say that is the whole idea of the idea of worshipping Rama or worshipping Krishna or thinking of Vishnu as lying on this bed of serpents. And all of this imagery is so that, because the mind needs variety to think of, and the Lord is presented to you in such variety. One Lord is like a mendicant. He does not have any jewels on him. The other one is so ornate that you can spend your whole day thinking of each ornament. You know, you can see all of these great poets. They've written verses and verses just on the ornaments of the God. Because the mind is by nature like that. It thinks of so many things. How many of those things can you all associate to God? How can you create an image of God, a symbol of God, so that the mind can be endlessly be kept occupied with these kind of thoughts of God?
A very important statement in this paragraph, I feel, is when Swami says, the attraction to God is spontaneous.
Right.
And all other attractions are self-imposed. Possibly because the mind seeks variety, it chooses multiple things, but finally Swami says that there is nothing like God. It's like a coming home. You know, I'm sure all of us have experienced this. We might be living in the coldest of places on earth, or possibly the hottest of places like we do at Puttaparthi. I mean, it's not like in the worldly sense Puttaparthi is a delight. In the worldly sense, no place is a delight as such. Because, you know, I had been to United States. You go to United States, you marvel at so many things there. Everything is so beautiful, so perfect, picture perfect, everything is amazing. But even in a place like that, Prem, after about 20 days, you feel, yeah, this is nice, but you know, let me get back to Puttaparthi. And I'm not saying it's because of Puttaparthi. If your home, and you know, Swami says, home is where the heart is. If your home is in Bangalore, you feel like that about Bangalore. If your home is in Atlanta, you may travel around the world and enjoy, but you still feel, let me get back home. I think God is like that spiritual home for us. We may enjoy other things, but we can't settle permanently anywhere. That is why if we go to any other place other than God, we are always unsettled. Because settling is possible only with God. You know, also it reminded me because of another thing that I love. I love traveling. The other thing I love is food. You know, we have something called a staple diet. And because of the region from where I come, for a staple diet is rice, sambar, curds. You know, this is my staple diet. I love pizzas. I love tacos. I love noodles. I love Chinese food. I love, you know, American food. I love all these. And in fact, whether you believe it or not, whenever I go to a restaurant, I never order rice, sambar and curds. Because I feel it would be a waste having come to a restaurant and ordering staple food. But guess what? 1 week passes and I don't get my rice, sambar and curds. I am craving back for this food. Because that's why it's called a staple food possibly. You know, it might not be the tastiest. It might not be what you look as a special diet, a special food. But whatever, however special the food might be, after some time you have to come back to your staple diet, though it may seem, in quotes, boring. I feel God is like that. God is that, in the sense that God is the only place where we can feel settled. This is my staple food, this is my hometown, and I am most comfortable here. I may enjoy other things, but this is where I am at home. You know, that's why those terms come there. So God is also like that, and Swami says, that is how it is for everyone. He is our natural home, and therefore, the attraction to God will come naturally. It will be there, you don't worry. You just, when it is there, remember that, keep in mind, intellectualize it, and also divinize it in your heart.
I think there was a conversation which was a little ahead of this, where Swami was talking about ananda and happiness and bliss. Mm. Where Swami says that, you know, it's almost like the trick that God has played on us, of course, not in the negative sense, where you've been given this craving for happiness and the true happiness is within. So everybody will eventually turn to this. You know, when you ask, there are so many people in the world who are atheists and so many people in the world who are worldly, who do not think of a higher purpose to life. Swami says that as long as they have the desire to find happiness and to sustain that happiness, they will eventually turn around and come to this. And Swami is saying that Rama is the ocean of delight. That final quenching of that thirst will only happen when you turn to this ocean and, you know, look to quench your thirst. And that's probably where Swami says that, you know, you might go anywhere, but eventually you will turn and come back to me. There's no way anybody can get lost forever from this, from the Lord.
It is so poetic also that Swami uses Rama, because in Sanskrit the term Rama, Ramyate iti Rama. Rama means that which attracts. And when you come to the world, you often think that why only Rama? Why? I mean, Rama is here a representation of that which attracts and also of the Lord. There is so many things that attract us in the world, and you think, okay, God is also one thing. But finally, like Swami says, that's why I think Swami has used Rama here and not Shiva or Ganesha, simply because Swami is also a poet, you know. Rama is also, in the beginning, Rama is one among the millions of things that attracts. But guess what? The world is so much filled with Maya that ultimately it's only Rama that will be the one that attracts you. All other things will make you restless.
Right, as you know, Tyagaraja very beautifully sings in one of his very famous kritis, he says, I don't know the exact words. He says, it's like a conversation that he's having towards to his mind. The famous one where he says, Nidhi Chala Sukama. In that he says, you know, you've tasted butter, you've tasted curd, you've tasted all these payasam and all of these delicacies. He says, mind you tell me, is any of that a match to the sweetness that Rama's name gives? Right? And the commentaries on that song always goes that he says the mind always knows, right? It'll never tell you that no, all of those delicacies were more tasty or delectable, because they say that the mind always knows, and this is an acknowledgement of what Swami was telling, you know, just a while ago. Mind by nature is very similar to the Atma and God than it is to the rest of the world. And what we do is we don't ask the mind. You know, we are probably scared of the answer. If I were to really sit and think, do I really need money? Do I really need material success? I am scared the answer will be, no, you don't need it. Right? And that's why I think most of us don't turn to the mind and ask this question. We would rather go with the flow and, you know, fulfill all our desires.
And another interesting thought that cropped in my mind when you said that was, look at the quality of conversation Tyagaraja had with himself, you know.
Right.
I think we should also elevate, it is not just about the company we keep in terms of others.
That is when you become your good company. Otherwise,
yes.
If you do not have that conversation.
So that thing that we, that Eleanor Roosevelt statement of whether we discuss people or events or ideas holds good even to when we think within ourselves. Whether I'm thinking of people, whether I'm thinking of events, or I'm thinking of ideas. I think that is something we should keep in mind. And next actually is a question that I think we have already broached a little bit upon. Shall we discuss it after the break, or shall we? Yeah, so dear listeners, we have actually introduced that theme, but we'll take a quick little break and on the other side of the break, continue with this conversation.
दर्पण में हो तुम,
Welcome back, dear listeners. We'll continue where we left off. Speaking of the mind, Hislop continues. He says, "Well, Swami, perhaps if one were to follow thought inward to its source and observe that source of thought, one might then have a quiet mind. In affairs of the world, thought is both necessary and practical. But when there is no need to be thinking, the mind still keeps on going with all sorts of idle thoughts. Whereas, one would be much better off if the mind would just be quiet." Swami immediately corrects him. Swami says, that is really the wrong way to approach the matter. The nature of the mind is restless, just like a rat whose nature is always to nibble at something, and just like a snake whose nature is to be biting at something, the nature of the mind is to be occupied. And even when still, like the feathers on a peacock, there is a shimmering, an apparent movement in the mind. Like the aspen tree, even on a still morning, its leaves seem to tremble and move. It is the nature of the mind to dwell upon things. So, the proper method to deal with the mind is to direct the mind's activity towards good deeds, good thoughts, repetition of the name of the Lord, and not allow it to aim at harmful objects, harmful thoughts and deeds. In that way, the mind's natural tendency to be occupied will be fulfilled, and yet it will keep out of mischief.
Right. And I think the reiteration of what we were just discussing, the most important thing that comes out in this is the acknowledgement and acceptance of the nature of the mind. I think most often we have these fantasies of, you know, what a state of samadhi is, or what a state of a person who is very spiritual is. And I think that's where all the problem starts. We are trying to match up with that idea of what we have built in our mind. And that's why I said some of these conversations are very relevant to Hislop's personal journey. I don't recall, because one of the things which he does is he actually goes and lives in a monk and...
No, he's also master. I think he's also
monk.
Transcendental mind,
right,
meditation.
Transcendental meditation. Of course, he spends a lot of time in Burma or someplace like that with Buddhist monks. Some of them have this practice of trying to absolutely still the mind, and, you know, they should not have any thoughts at all. And these are extreme practices. And Swami would say that these are not validated by anybody, or not necessarily one has to do all of these things. So one thing which comes forth very strongly in this is Swami saying that this is the nature of the mind, and an acceptance that this is a mind created by God and given for a certain purpose. And all that is required is marshalling of the mind and, you know, using it in the right manner. You don't have to put it through any kind of torture or put it through any kind of extreme disciplining, which is not necessary. In fact, the journey of Buddha himself is like that. You know, he goes through extreme starvation and self-abnegation, and then he says that this is meaningless. You know,
in fact, the middle path is one of his main teachings.
Right. Then finally, that's what he says. You know, what is required is the middle path. Because he gets attracted to that, the idea of being a renunciant. And that's how his journey starts. He sees a dead man, he sees a sick man, and all of that. And finally, he sees a monk and he gets attracted to the idea that here is someone who is trying to find happiness beyond all the material and impermanence of life. But then he takes to that path, and they say that very swiftly he becomes one of the masters because he's so good at it. He's so good at denying his body comforts. He's so good at starvation, at keeping awake and meditating and all of that. And, of course, the story goes that finally he's so starved that somebody comes and gives him a village girl by name Sujata comes and gives him some milk and rice. And the moment he eats it, the kind of soothing nature that he finds in the body and the mind, he says that this is meant to be, right? You're not supposed to lose yourself in this pleasure, but you're not meant to deny this also. So he says that extremes are not right. The middle path is right.
Ati and then, sarvatra right, vajayet.
Yeah, and he becomes very unpopular. Instantly, all the people around him desert him and go away. They say that you're fallen from the path. But then he says, no, you've all got it wrong. This is the path. Right? So Swami is saying that acceptance of nature of the mind, and there are some tools, there are some ways of life by which you ensure that the mind does not take you towards more bondage. And Swami is saying that that's all you need to do.
See, it's like I feel when you're going across a river or going across the sea, you're going on a cruise, you're enjoying the cruise, no doubt. You are there for a higher purpose of, you know, taking in the nature and everything. But if the boat requires repairs, you can't say that I'm here for enjoying the cruise, I can't do the repair. You just stop everything and do the repair. I think that is what Buddha also realized, and Swami says that also. I mean, take that much care of the boat so that you can enjoy the scenery and not worry about the boat. So we have to take care of the body, and that is why the story that comes to my mind is what Swami would say of how a man gets a genie to do all his work. And finally, he's at his wit's end. He doesn't know what to do with the genie, because the genie also comes along with a curse that if you don't give work to the genie, it will come and destroy you. So the genie is so fast that all the work that this man can ever think of it's doing. But then when he's running out of work, he doesn't know. So he rushes back to his master who had gifted him this genie and says, Master, you take back your genie because I can't give it any more work. And when it's idle, it destroys me. And Swami says, the master tells him that there's a very simple solution to this. Take a pole and fix it in your yard. Whenever there's no work for the genie, tell it to keep going up and down till you tell it to stop. Let it keep going up and down that pole. When you have work, summon the genie, let it finish the task. When the task is over, send it back again. And this man is very happy because his problem is solved. And Swami says, each one of us have been given a genie like that, a genie which is called the mind, which has great capacity to achieve great things. But the problem is the moment it becomes idle, it will come and destroy you. And that's why whenever it is idle, fix the pole of the Lord's name and make it go up and down the name of the Lord. In fact, you know, it doesn't matter whether the pole is wooden or iron or metal. In the same way, it doesn't matter which name of the Lord we take up, but take up the name of the Lord. And that is what Swami says, because Hislop is asking here that we need the mind for functioning in the world. But at other times when it's not needed, when it's idle, it goes off to other places. It is at such times that I want to negate it and completely silence it. Swami says, no, at such time, engage in thoughts of God, do namasmarana, do bhajan, do all this. I think that is the solution. It also helps those of us who have the question that if I have to do constant namasmarana, how can I do my daily activities? Swami is not saying that when you're teaching history or science in the class, chant Sairam Sairam. No. Teach your history and science. At that time, use the mind to do that. But then after that, when you're sitting by yourself in the cafeteria, instead of thinking anything else, think of the Lord. It works both ways. You know, for those who are steeped in the world and saying, I don't have time for Swami. And for those who are saying that it becomes terrible, I want to make the mind go away, what I should do. Swami says, no, don't make it go away. Instead, bring in thoughts of God.
And maybe we'll just go through the next paragraph, because after that, I would like to share a very beautiful incident, which not an, exactly an incident, but the approach that Swami would have towards the spiritual path itself. Mm. Swami goes on to say, another essential means for keeping the mind away from harmful activities is work. Mm. Man is made to work hard, and if one is working hard in service to the Lord, in one way or the other, the mind will not have time to be occupied with useless random thoughts. And if there is no outside work, then the work of the spiritual endeavor should go on, in the way of meditation, recitation of the name, reading good books, talking with good people, and so on. And if you look at it, I mean, this paragraph is probably the fundamental bedrock of whatever Swami has set up in the hostel, in the institutions. If you look at it, one hand, you're so occupied that you do not have time to sit and think of anything else. I think that's how our hostel life can be defined. You're constantly going from one activity to the other. And on top of that, Swami will give other works, you know, your academic work one side, your hostel activity one side. And there will be something that centered around Swami that will keep you occupied. Some festival coming, some program coming. One hand, that kind of being completely occupied. And the other hand, there would be silence. Right? If you come and sit in Mandir, if you sit in waiting for Swami's darshan, or in any other time, you would find, so your day is literally shifting between complete activity where there is no space for your mind to think of anything else. And then there is the silence where it's like the atmosphere around you makes you sit down and think of something which is more noble and which is more elevated, to do Namasmarana or something like that. Like some of the old students whom we were talking to, who were there in the Vrindavan days, you were saying that this is how our life was. Mm. Almost 90% of the day you're occupied. You're either working in the Gokulam, you're working in the fields, or you know, you're cleaning something, you're doing some gardening. The rest of the time you're occupied with silence. Because Swami was so fond of silence that that silence would literally be deafening. You cannot miss that silence. Like he was saying a very beautiful incident of Swami. He was talking about silence, and they were all sitting around Swami, and Swami said, okay, all of you now, just keep quiet for some time. So there was pin drop silence around Swami, and Swami asked, what do you hear? So they said, Swami, we hear some chirping of some birds, and I think those were the days when there were a lot of deers around and all that. So they said, Swami, we hear all of these sounds. And Swami said, beyond that sound, what do you hear? And they could hear a distant rumble of a truck which was going on the road, right? Those days, the main road outside Vrindavan was not so busy. So otherwise, you wouldn't have heard that sound. Because Swami was saying that, in the silence, what do you hear? Mm. So they said, Swami, we can hear a truck going. And Swami said, now concentrate beyond that and see what you're hearing. And literally for a few seconds, they said that we could hear the silence which is above and beyond all these other sounds which are around us. Right? And just then it seems one of the elders who was attending to Swami just comes into the room, and you know, somebody had come for Swami, or the lunch was ready or something, and he came in and broke that news, right? And this the student was narrating it. That person actually came and whispered. He said, Swami, your lunch is ready or something like that. And he jerked because he felt that was so loud. Right? So he was saying that there was so much silence around Swami that your mind was completely drawn towards a higher state, even whether you want it or not. Either it's completely occupied or you're given the silence to contemplate on. Right? And he was telling a very beautiful incident once. The same student, apparently Ram Ramam was not keeping well those days. So one day he came and told Swami that, Swami, it would be nice if two or three boys are there in old bungalow staying here, so that early in the morning I go away to the fields and all that. Somebody will be here till 7 o'clock in case you need something. So Swami said, yeah, you go to the hostel and pick up some two, three senior boys and come. So that's how two, three senior boys were called, and this student was one of them. And they all would go away for Suprabhatam. And then Ram Ramam said, no, I want you to be here. So this boy said, why not? We'll volunteer. We can skip Suprabhatam. We can sleep for a little longer. And you're spending time in Swami's bungalow, right? It's a bonanza in that sense. So he volunteered and he was there. So he was saying that one day when he was all alone sleeping there around 6 in the morning, he heard some movement, right? Somebody walking around or, you know, something like that. So he was wondering who has come in into Swami's premises and who is walking around. He went to the window, he couldn't see any movement. So he said, okay, later in the day I'll tell Ram Ramam. And then he went and told Ram Ramam, sir, I heard some footsteps around. And immediately Ram Ramam said, shh, don't tell anybody. So he said, what is it, sir? It's Swami taking a walk around. Okay. And he said, Swami, don't tell anybody, keep it within ourselves that we'll enjoy it, that kind of thing, okay. So apparently a few weeks later, Swami was sitting with students and Swami was talking about how important it is to go for a morning walk and do some exercise and all that. And then Swami said, see, I don't have that opportunity. I cannot take a walk outside because then all the devotees will come. So then Swami said, I walk inside my room, I go into the dining hall and all that. So immediately Ram Ramam said, yes, Swami, we know that you walk. Swami asked, how do you know? Because we hear your footsteps. Swami said, nonsense, how can you hear my footsteps? First of all, Swami walks very softly. And then it's all carpeted on Swami's floor. So there's no way you can hear Swami's footsteps. So Ram Ramam was protesting. He said, no, Swami, I've heard. And he turned to this boy and said, this boy also has heard. So then Swami turned to him and said, hey, have you heard? So this boy was scared to say whether he has heard or not. Because he was thinking, if I say I've heard, what if Swami stops taking that walk? Thinking that, you know, maybe people are getting disturbed or something. Or, you know, Swami gets upset with him because Swami might be wanting him to take Swami's side. So this boy was thinking for some time and he said, Swami, when there is absolute silence, very softly I can hear your steps. And instantly Swami said, when there is absolute silence, the footsteps of God can be heard.
Beautiful.
Swami said. Right? So, you know, Swami was playing with the same words that he said and it was not more than just that physical thing. So that beautiful, synthesis of me keeping you completely occupied so the mind does not have anything else to think of. And when there is nothing to be occupied, giving you that kind of silence where the mind automatically reaches out to something higher rather than getting lost in worldly thoughts.
In music, there are two aspects. There is the melody and there is a rhythm. If one of them is also missing, it's no longer music. If there's no melody, it's not music. And I think this, music not being music because there is no melody is something that's commonly understood. But this rhythm part is something that you need training to understand. You may possibly understand and feel that, hey, this is something that is going off. But you won't know what is it that is going off unless you're trained. Because if the rhythm goes off, the whole thing goes off. And we have seen many times how, you know, Swami would turn and frown at the tabla player for missing a beat. I mean, that is the perfectionist that God is. None would have noticed also, but that's what happens. Now, why I brought this up is, while melody is constituted by the notes that are played, the rhythm comes because of the silence that exists between the notes. You know, depending on how long or how short the silence is, the rhythm gets generated. Which means that for music to be music, both are important, the notes and the silence between the notes. And I feel that's how Swami made our life into a musical one, into a music that is fit to be offered to the Lord. Because as Swami says, the Lord is Ganapriya. He's a lover of music. And I feel, while on one hand it stands for the physical music that was presented in his presence, it is also this music in life, the rhythm of life, which is punctuated by periods of silence along with periods of intense activity. Swami ensured that the notes are perfect. He also ensured that the silence is perfect, because For the rhythm of life, we need both the music and the rhythm. And I think that just makes us very grateful to Swami. On that note, dear listeners, we will stop our discussion here. The discussion on the mind continues, and I think we will go on for a couple more weeks or a couple more fortnights on this. But as of now, the time in our studios is 1:55, and we will conclude here. As always, with humility and love, we offer this at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. And we will leave you with a song, on the other side of which you will be joined by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
सफर में दिल चलने लगा है, फूलों के इन बगियों में मन टहलने चला है, यादों के सफर में दिल चलने लगा है, फूलों की इन बगियों में मन टहलने चला है, कुछ तो है इन ख्वाबों में दिल से निकलते नहीं, कुछ तो है इन राहों में मिलती यहाँ हर खुशी, अब इन लम्हों के बारिश में भीगने चला हूँ मैं, यादों के सफर में दिल चलने लगा है, फूलों के बगियों में मन टहलने चला है।
बगियों में मन पहले चला है।